Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Trish Sahar. Trish has personal experience of autism and an eating disorder, and today we discuss her experience of having an eating disorder and then realising down the line that she was autistic. We speak about some nuances in terms of autism and eating disorders, and I'm really grateful for Trish exploring these with me in such an open-minded way. So, just for the listeners, because I don't do pretending, this is the second time that we've tried this because I didn't click record, and it's also about the 50 millionth time that we've tried this because of technical issues and dates and times and life getting in the way. So thankfully Trish is being extremely patient with me.
Oh, you've been lovely.
We're gonna have a cracking episode because of it.
Yes, so
we'll crack right on because we we've done this, you know, a few times, but anyway.
So
for the listeners, do you want to explain who you are and what you're passionate about and why you wanted to come on to Full of Beans today?
Okay, well, first of all, shout out to Hannah for creating such an inspirational platform and for the work that she has done and continues to do. So my name's Trish. I'm 23 years old, and I it feels like I'm like reading a bio on a dating website. But
loosen it up, you know, jazz it out. You don't need to make it scripted.
I'm really keen to talk about the link between autism and eating disorders, because I think being autistic is a blessing in some ways. It can help you think things through quite deeply, and often, you know, we've seen quite a few people historically who are very successful and are also autistic. But there is a clear link, I think, between being autistic and being more likely to suffer from mental health conditions, specifically eating disorders. And I want to raise awareness of that, but also hopefully change the way our inpatient and outpatient mental health services approach that interlink.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's something that we've spoken about quite a lot on the podcast in terms of the prevalence of eating disorders and neurodiversity, and how, you know, some aspects of neurodiversity can be brilliant and really help somebody in different aspects of their life. But equally, because particularly with autism, and if we're thinking about anorexia, a lot of the behaviours can be quite similar. It can be really difficult to pick apart of like, what is the autism? What is the eating disorder? What do I need to recover from? What's actually like a behaviour that is part of my autism that maybe I need to, you know, change the focus rather than it being around food and body. And I guess with that in mind, from your, like, based on your personal experience, did you know that you had autism when you got diagnosed with your eating disorder, or is that something that you found out later on?
No, so I found it out later on. So I think growing up for me, I was a quiet kid. I was bullied quite badly in primary school because of the way I looked, in terms of I had I'm annoyed with my parents for it, but I had like a bowl haircut. I look kind of like Spock. And I would like often walk around with like a radio in my bag. I don't know why. I really liked it. And its antenna would stick out my bag, and I don't know what was wrong. I looked like a beautiful overgrown little caterpillar. But it was difficult, that period. But also I was bullied for putting my hand up a lot in class, and a lot of people thought that I was drawing attention to myself. And I never had a clear idea of who I was, but other people noticing me then led me to notice myself and notice imperfections about myself. So when I was diagnosed with anorexia when I was 12 years old, when I was admitted to my first hospital, and it was 2.5 years later that I started, to even think about the fact that I might have autism, and then get that formal diagnosis, which is a very difficult process for a lot of people as well.
What was it that made you think, I might need, I might have autism and I want to go for the diagnosis?
So I was an inpatient during that time. It wasn't the same admission, but I was an inpatient during that time. And I think I have got to say that it's a particular doctor who noticed that I had certain rigid patterns of thinking that seemed to go deeper than just my eating disorder. It seemed to be, I seemed to find it quite tough to communicate, often for long periods of time. And I also found it quite difficult to tell people what I was actually feeling. And that meant that I didn't properly engage with a lot of different traditional eating disorder therapies, and could have been the reason why I kept getting admitted. I was also very fixated on certain ritualistic behaviors, organizing things in a certain way, and it seemed, and it basically prompted my doctors to actually have a look and think, maybe she has autism, maybe she's neurodiverse, maybe there's something else that we should explore.
I think that's really interesting, and especially what you just said there about sort of the doctor noticed that your behaviors kind of extended further than just food and body. Because from what I've heard from other professionals and people with experience similar to yours, that's what they've kind of said is, look out for those things that extend further than just food and body, because the anorexia tends to be fixated and rigid around them. But with autism, it might be kind of aspects broader than that. And I was thinking there about the inpatient stay that you had, and if you were, well, you are autistic, how did you find the whole adjustment to inpatient? Because I imagine for somebody that's not neurodivergent, that must be difficult. But then for somebody that has, rigid behaviors in order to keep themselves safe, or to feel safe, I can imagine that being moved to an inpatient facility must have been really difficult.
So I have been admitted as an inpatient, around about 6 times throughout my throughout my adolescence, and it's sort of in and out of inpatient units. And I think it was very much the same process every single time. I don't think anyone learned from any of my previous admissions. And so when I was admitted, I was immediately thrown into a community of other patients with various presentations of eating disorders. And I wanted to be liked. I really didn't know where I was and how long I was going to be there. It didn't feel like there was any marker that I knew that I had to reach and then I would be recovered. I was very confused with what recovery means in the first place anyway. And I thought that I needed to be liked by everyone around me, but I couldn't understand how they were behaving. And so as a result, I learned quite a few behaviors at that age that then became quite fixed for me. So, like maybe a little bit of a trigger warning, but behaviors related to hiding food, and behaviors relating to trying to increase my levels of exercise secretly in the night, which are behaviors that I didn't previously, that weren't previously there before I was admitted as an inpatient. The environment itself was chaotic for me. I suddenly felt as if everything that I had habit-wise that was that I could rely on, everything had gone, and I was now forced to adhere to these rules with no definite or indefinite end date.
But do you think, I guess just kind of playing devil's advocate, do you think that that was because you had autism, you kind of looked at those behaviors and picked them up? Because I can imagine for somebody with anorexia, at that point when you are in an inpatient setting, the eating disorder is pretty ingrained. And I think that comparison is a massive driving force in inpatient settings. So I would imagine people would maybe look at others' behaviors and maybe not in the way of trying to gain others' approval and be liked by everybody, but I would imagine that there is that sort of seeing other behaviors and then, worsening your own symptoms in an inpatient setting.
I think for me, it was wanting to appease and fit into this unknown mold of what I was seen as. So up until that point, I didn't really know what was going on. Like I was 12 years old, and I had done something that I thought was gonna give me more control, and suddenly I'd entered this new environment, and people saw me. I believe that people saw me in a certain way as a person with anorexia. So, as a result of that, I did almost everything I could to fit that mold. And I see a lot of those behaviors as being driven by my eating disorder, but I would also end up copying how people spoke. I would end up copying how people sat or what people would wear. All of it was about trying to be unnoticed, trying to not be sort of considered the other. And that made me quite, I felt quite excluded as well, because I felt like I was constantly trying to be someone that was the perfect anorexic or the perfect patient. So I would say things to the clinicians that would make people think that I was better, just so that they thought, oh, she's a good patient, just so that they liked me. And yeah, I think that's an interesting sort of mishmash of autistic habits and having an eating disorder. And I think as a result of that, I didn't know how to start unraveling that.
Which was going to be my next question is, how on earth did you and the clinicians that you were working with even start to unravel that? Because I think from my perspective and my experience, and I'm not neurodivergent, for me, untangling Hannah from the eating disorder has been really, really hard. But I think untangling Trish from the autism, from the eating disorder, adds another element in there. And it's, yeah, another element of something, do I need to recover from that, or is that part of me? And I think that's what makes it really difficult.
I think it's for me realizing that there are certain fixed things that I like a routine. I like doing, the same things every day. I have trouble dealing with lots of change, but I think the first step in recovery was to analyze all my rigid thinking patterns and think basically, is this in short having a abject negative effect on my physical and mental well-being? So it is kind of allowing for it's trusting someone enough to rely on their opinion when they say that, oh, this behavior is, it's evident of anorexic tendencies, hiding food or feeling the sort of impulsive need to do so isn't, a helpful behavior. And it's pinpointing that. And also for me, realizing that the habits and the rituals that I did like, so I liked being able to go to school. I loved school growing up. But I was in hospital for 6 years, really sort of in and out. And while I was in hospital, I couldn't go to school. And for me, I realized that in order to build those habits that were dear to me, that had a positive impact on me, I had to let go or work on some of the habits that were pulling me back.
Would you say that it's fair enough as a very broad statement to say that regardless of whether the habit is coming from autism or an eating disorder or yourself, if it's a habit that's having a negative impact on you, then it needs to change? Because I think like sometimes when I say that out loud, that sounds so obvious, but I think sometimes when we talk about neurodiversity, we because there's been so much stigma and so many stereotypes against neurodiversity, it's kind of like, any behavior associated with it needs to stay, and it's okay to have it. But actually, I think we're being, almost not looking at the elephant in the room, and that, if anything is having a negative impact on you, then it's something that needs to change. It could be something that we all engage in everyday life. Let's take exercise, for example. To random Joe blogs on the street, exercising is a great thing to do for your mental health, but when that becomes excessive, that's not then good for you, and that's something you need to change.
Yeah, and I think that, the reason why people who do practice like quite unhealthy habits keep doing it is because, we measure things in society by people's physical appearances. So people could find it really, really difficult to not exercise at, let's say, 8 a.m. every day, but no one would notice it because of the fact that maybe they are perceived as being of normal size. So I feel like for me, neurodiversity is I sometimes take longer to understand new tasks or new concepts. So if someone's saying, oh, this word means this or this, let's say they talk about like a new innovation, they're like, ah, this is to do with AI or whatever. I'll read something and I will take longer to understand it. I will perhaps need to be more visual in the way that I understand it. In the way that when people explain things to do, if people, for example, my manager is like, you should do this task, sometimes I need extra clarification. Sometimes I don't understand sarcasm or those kind of things. And those, I think, are expressions of neurodiversity that should be embraced and should be allowed for within the professional and within everyone's professional and personal lives. It shouldn't be considered odd or weird if you need that bit extra. But things become almost bordering on obsessive when, even if you like routine breaking or something getting in the way or something disrupting that causes you deep emotional pain, or it causes you to feel uneasy in such a way that you can't do things that are good for yourself. So when I did learn about autism and when I realized that I was autistic, I realized that, you know, I found it difficult to analyze people's facial expressions. That is something that you can manage, and that is something that can be accommodated for. But I also, in the first stages before I started recovering, used that to almost justify, oh, so I'm autistic, so I only like my food served in, let's say, a particular way or separated or something like that. And it was realizing that the difference between those is perhaps, you know, I think what you're getting at there.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. And I think I'm so glad that you said that, because sometimes I'm like, oh, can I say that? But this may come out wrong, but I mean it with the best intentions. Like you said at the start, like, your autism can help you to thrive and the characteristics, you know, can be really positive. But when you start using them as an excuse for your eating disorder, I just don't think that that's healthy. And I've seen quite a lot on social media in terms of, like, you know, oh, I have to do something a certain way because of my autism. But I've never been able to distinguish if it's having a negative impact on you. How is that different from just saying I have to do that because I have an eating disorder? And I think we would all, you know, deep down say that using your eating disorder as an excuse for something is not healthy. It's not positive long term. So if you're using your autism as an excuse to engage in an eating disorder behavior, I would argue that that's just as negative for your long term mental health.
Yeah, because I think being autistic means that, you know, you've got rigid patterns of thinking, and that means that it's difficult for you to perhaps, you know, even think about recovery and think about changing. But, you know, I've been autistic probably my whole life, but I haven't suffered from anorexia for my whole life. These behaviors, these habits, these fixations that have happened, they are something other than the autism. And I think it's recognizing that, you know, behaviors that seem, you know, I can't not, again, trigger warning, but I can't not, you know, I can't not do 50 sit-ups at this time. I can't not do this. All these things are brought on externally to the autism. And therefore, the autism doesn't justify that. And I think when you do, you know, use your autism or think that it offers an excuse for some eating disorder behaviors, it's to try and keep things the same. It's to try and remain the way that you are. Remain doing the things that you're doing and almost not hold yourself accountable for it, because people with autism are typically incredibly logical. They, you know, think things through and they understand. We say that we pride ourselves on understanding cause and effect. That's how it materializes for me. You know, sometimes when I don't understand why, for example, if someone does something wrong, they might get off scot-free, or some people who, you know, guilty but get to live their life normally even though they've committed a crime. I don't understand that. But as a result, when I use that same approach to an eating disorder, logically it seems incorrect that someone would want to engage in those behaviors. Why would someone want to make themselves feel hungry, uncomfortable, and, you know, like insufficient? Why would someone want to do that? It doesn't logically make sense. But by saying that, oh, my autism makes me behave like that, that justifies it, I think, for yourself more than anyone else. And I think that's why I was so stuck in you know, the way that I was. And it wasn't helped by the fact that, you know, the markers that people were measuring me by to be good enough to recover were weight. And it was, you gain enough weight and you will be discharged. And that was just, that was, you know, characteristic of all my admissions.
So each time did you just kind of gain the weight that you needed to be discharged and then ended up back again?
Yes. And also I think it did definitely materialize in different ways for me. I think I had learned, I think a lot of this is probably just, it's probably quite typical of an eating disorder, just having an eating disorder. I thought that I was in, I was forced to be in hospital. I wanted to get out so that I could get back to my idea of what control was. And I was going to do whatever it took to get there. And then when I was discharged, I could go back to the way that I was behaving, because I thought, also with my autism, I thought that that was the way that I was meant to be, and that everyone was trying to force me to be something that I didn't want to be. But it is then realizing that that version of myself that I was incongruous with the kind of version that autistic me wanted to be. Autistic me wanted me to be someone who was clever. I really liked, I was the only time I felt like I could truly focus, or something that I had full control over, I felt, was like learning things. And there was like a clear thing with like maths, like I do this thing, it is right or it is wrong. And I was like, that I understand, that I can hold on to, and that I enjoy. But I am not, you know, getting to do that while I'm in hospital. And I think realizing what was important to me in that sense. But I also think that recovery, a lot of people talk about, you know, that time when it flipped a switch for them, and I don't think it ever flipped a switch for me. It was a gradual unpicking of everything, and a gradual sort of logical unraveling of who was who in this, you know, mess that I felt myself in. But yeah,
I think it definitely like depends on the individual, but I would agree, for me it wasn't like a flick of a switch of one day I woke up and I was like, oh shit, I realized what I need to do, or like I don't want to be ill anymore. It's kind of, for me it was trying different things and seeing what worked, and actually, you know, where are these behaviors coming from and why do I want to do them. But I wonder, and it might not have been this kind of simple, was it sort of in your last admission that there was something different in the way that they supported you that then meant that you went on to recover from your eating disorder? Or was it not really any different and it was sort of stuff that you did outside of the admission?
So I think it was, I think by that stage, I, you know, I had been sort of in and out of hospital so much that I had realized at this point that, you know, being admitted and it wasn't giving me any joy. And And I knew that I did want to change simply because I didn't want to feel, you know, I've always wanted to not feel to fit in, and I didn't fit in to the rest of my peers by being, as in my school friends and everything, by being in hospital. So I realized that I wanted to get better, but I was so scared of my own brain by that point. So I got to the stage where I didn't know the difference between my autistic voice and my eating disorder. So I almost didn't trust anything I thought. So I thought I would just sit there thinking all the time, and I wouldn't be able to speak to people because I'd be like, oh, is that the eating disorder telling me to say hello to this person, or is it the autism telling me to say? And it got that, you know, difficult for me. And I think, you know, at that point I had been sort of nasally fed by that stage with the known as the tube. And it was, you know, it was that time all the control I wanted to have had been taken away from me. And I think I saw and this could have been the trigger for me. I saw a speech and language therapist, and, you know, she showed me how I could use different communication techniques. I could use different ways of learning things to, or understanding things. So, for example, understanding someone being sarcastic, or understanding things about uncertain things, how I could understanding my autism in that sense. And she had no eating disorder experiences. She just told me what behaviors, you know, that I could use that were autistic, that could be beneficial to me and that could make me happy. And I think she told me that not everything autistic is also your eating disorder. And like, not everything eating disorder related is autistic. And I think it's making that decision that I wanted to work on figuring out a way to think that would genuinely make me happy and would have a positive impact on me. And I think it's something that I go through day to day. I'll want to do something a certain way. I'll want to organize something in a certain way, or I'll feel unsure when someone is like, makes a joke. I won't know how to respond. But it's being compassionate with yourself in that moment. And I think that it's that point with an eating disorder, you're never compassionate with yourself. You never think that nothing is ever, you know, okay or enough, or it's that feeling of constant chaos that's in you. No matter if you fulfill a rigid pattern of thinking, you still think that you're, you know, that something's wrong. And I think learning to be compassionate with myself, learning that it's a journey, was kind of the main thing that helped me recover. Also building new habits with with my studies, and also just trying out different things and being okay with being like, okay, so I'm going to try knitting, and if that doesn't work, I am okay with letting that go and moving on to, you know, let's go for something crazy like crocheting. Still don't understand how people are confident with just, yeah, people are just like weaving things with one little hook. Like, that is not humanly possible. Like, I've seen it and I still don't get it. Like, grandmas all around the world, and hopefully granddads in the future if we finally balance things out gender wise. Yes. Like, they're doing some magic work there. But yeah, that's, I think I rambled. Yes.
No, I think it was wonderful. And it's so nice to hear because I think I can really resonate with a lot of what you were saying. And it sounds so stupid. And I think it's so annoying when you're in the like depth of despair of an eating disorder. But I mean, maybe this isn't the case for everybody, but for me, it definitely was. Like I had to really hit rock bottom to be like, oh my God, I am missing out on so much, and like I can't do the things I want to do right now. I don't think it was until I personally realized like I can't do this thing that I want to do. I can't go out with my friends and simply eat. I can't go out with my friends and simply chat. Like, and to me, they seemed like such like difficult, hard things to do. And then actually, I think I realized one day, I was like, wow, a lot of people can just, this is like instinctive. This, they're not having to think about this. And I think for me, it was realizing that I wanted that as well. And I wanted that more than I wanted my eating disorder. That took a lot of time to realize that, those things were more important. And that was a lot of work of like shifting priorities. But I think equally, what you mentioned about trying something and being afraid to try something and it not work, because so much of the time we are, particularly, with anorexia, it's perfectionism. So, if I'm doing recovery, I'm doing recovery perfectly. Like I'm not doing it and then failing at recovery. But, it was coming to that realization that one bad day doesn't mean that I failed. And actually, like you said, it is a journey. And however long that, that may take will depend on the different person. But somebody, I have tried so many times to try journaling. I hate journaling. I cannot stand it. Like that, I just don't want to write down my thoughts and feelings on a piece of paper. And that's not like, oh, I don't want to because I don't want to sort of come to terms with it. Sending like recording a voice note and just getting it out into the open and not sending it to anyone, that's perfect for me. But writing it down, it just doesn't work. But I had to come to terms with the fact that that was something that was right for other people and wasn't right for me. And I think that's part of recovery that can be quite challenging.
So I think you'll get. I think it's also because our the way that we support people with eating disorders, we try and make it fit into like a clear mold. Like you'll read everywhere, like journaling will definitely help or something like that. Or and if you don't want to journal, then like you were saying, you're trying to avoid that. But no, a recovery is very different, and it is not at all linear, because I think, even despite whatever happened for me, every time I did leave hospital, a part of me did think, I'm not going to be back here. And I was. And I think for me, that I learned to feel uncomfortable with that uncertainty. I don't want to know that tomorrow someone is going to, tomorrow I'll see a doctor, and tomorrow I'll be in a hospital. I don't want to have that, fear in myself. I don't want people to, have that kind of power over me. And that's, I think, it's hard to get that balance where, wanting to be in control is a positive thing, and that means taking ownership for yourself and being the best version of yourself that you can be. And when it's, I want to engage in these negative habits and I don't want anyone to stop me. And it's finding that balance that I don't think is, it's not clear cut. And I don't think people are recovering. We know during our recovery, but it's something that is a kind of trial and error process, but it is possible, and it is possible to feel comfortable in your own brain.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And thank you so much for that little bit of hope at the end there that it is totally possible, because I think it is. And I think we do hear so much that recovery isn't possible, but I think we have this particular idea, particularly on social media, of what recovery looks like. And maybe that's not possible, but everyone has their own recovery and what that looks like for them. And I definitely think that is possible. I just wanted to finish. We've obviously spoken a lot about inpatient and autism and eating disorders. If there's any clinicians listening, obviously this is going to completely depend on the person. But is there any kind of broad advice that you would give to somebody when they're supporting somebody that, you know, potentially doesn't have an autism diagnosis, but they think are showing signs or does have an autism diagnosis, and how to navigate supporting them with their recovery?
So I think, I think it's allowing for the fact that giving the patient the opportunity to really to kind of express how they communicate differently and in the care that you give. So for example, I would say what really benefited me is when in actual fact someone sat down and explained to me, you know, this is why we're doing this, because we want this outcome, and this is, you know, we want you to have this meal because this will help you form a healthy habit, and this will mean that you will be able to go out with your mum and have, you know, a sandwich in Starbucks. And sometimes being that explicit and being that, you know, able to explain something a little bit differently, not be like, okay, you're admitted into here and you will remain here until, you know, until we see that it's necessary for you to leave. But instead of saying that, to say, perhaps you're here because we believe these certain things, and this is the evidence that shows that. And once we have the evidence that this is no longer true, then we will think about discussing recovery. It's also that kind of healthy reassurance, I think, is quite useful as well. So realizing, you know, that this person with their autism and with their eating disorder, you know, no matter what form that comes in, they have things that they love and things that they enjoy and things that they should nurture. And those are things that they can hold on to even when they feel as if they've lost all control. And I think with people who are autistic that get eating disorders, I think they are very scared of this new pattern of thinking that suddenly controls them. They're scared of their eating disorder. I was definitely terrified of my eating disorder at first. I thought that I didn't understand why I felt this need to do all these things. And I think it's being compassionate about that as well, and understanding, you know, they're in a new environment. They're in a totally different, and this is for everyone with autism or not, they're in a totally new environment. So don't immediately expect them to behave like every other patient you've got. Don't expect them to, if they're not, you know, engaging in group therapy, that doesn't mean that they don't want to get better. That might mean that they don't know how to make friends with these, they don't know what to say, and they're finding it hard to, you know, be open with other people. So I think those are kind of the main things that I would say, but definitely be open to the fact that, you know, an eating disorder is, you know, it's got some trait characteristics, but they're not all, you can't lift, you know, an anorexic description out of a textbook.
Yeah. Do you know, I think I completely agree with what you said. And I think that that is just across the board, like regardless of whether somebody is neurodiverse or not. I think seeing them as a unique person and listening to what is going to support them, because ultimately, yes, I know that they're an inpatient, but they might have an idea of things that are going to help them. And maybe that will take some time to actually unpick what will actually help them rather than what will help their eating disorder. But I think, you know, we are all unique individuals and we are humans. And with that, like you've said, everybody has things that they enjoy. And again, the eating disorder might have stripped that from somebody, but helping somebody to work out what they enjoy and what they can bring with them. Because like you said, you know, going into hospital, I can imagine, is a terrifying experience. And a lot of people have to go really far away from home. They don't have their family. You were 12 years old. To go to a hospital setting at 12 years old, away from your family, you know, not knowing what's going on, not knowing why you're engaging in those behaviours, not knowing why you can't stop. I think, you know, really have some compassion there that, you know, people may not act like the perfect patients when they first walk in, and they may not seem like they want to recover, but those things definitely take time. And I think that with, you know, inpatient, outpatient, wherever you are, patients will take time to come around. But I think this is one thing I've said before, in that I can imagine eating disorder patients are one of the most frustrating patients to work with, because if somebody's like got a broken arm or something, they'll go and they want to fix it because it's, you know, it's frustrating, it's annoying having a broken arm. So they'll probably do their physio, it will last a bit of time, and then they'll be really grateful for your help. But with eating disorders, you know, they might not do the things that you're telling them to do. They won't seem grateful because the things that you're doing are the things that are in their worst nightmares. And you may not see the end of their journey. So I can imagine it's quite a frustrating patient group, but having compassion for them and, you know, holding hope for them is really important.
Yeah. I agree. Totally.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Trish, thank you so much. I'm so glad we finally got to do this.
Yeah.
It has been an absolute pleasure. And please do keep in touch. And yeah, it was lovely to meet you, although I can't see your face.
Yes. I have my make sure you listen to Hannah, and I have my own podcast called Quirky Thoughts, where I talk about, you know, weird things I didn't understand that day, or how I got over, you know, wanting to open a door for one person, then standing there for 40 minutes not knowing where to go because I didn't want to inconvenience anyone, and being late to the rest of my meetings for that day. So do listen to that if you can.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll put a link to Quirky Thoughts in the show notes, and do all the relevant things on social media. But thank you so much, Trish, and thank I hope you. You have a lovely evening.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye. If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.